Toad by Mary Oliver. I was walking by. He was sitting there. It was full morning, so the heat was heavy on his sand-colored head and his webbed feet. I squatted beside him at the edge of the path. He didn't move. I began to talk. I talked about summer and about time, the pleasures of eating, the terrors of the night, and about this cup we call a life, about happiness and how good it feels, the heat of the sun between the shoulder blades. He looked neither up nor down, which didn't necessarily mean he was either afraid or asleep. I felt his energy stored under his tongue, perhaps, or behind his bulging eyes. I talked about how the world seems to me 5 feet tall, the blue sky all around my head. I said, I wondered how it seemed to him down there, intimate with the dust. He might have been a Buddha, did not move, blink, or frown. Not a tear fell from those gold-rimmed eyes as the refined anguish of language passed over him. I like the way Mary Oliver writes her poetry. I never knew anything about Mary Oliver until I started going to Sims, and Rodney used to read Mary Oliver poems all the time, but I understand why he did. Just think for a minute, this refined anguish of language. That phrase is so, this is what we're moving into here. We're hopefully moving out of the refined anguish of language and moving into a way of beginning to perceive the world without all that. And we're not perceiving the world without language because it's a better way to perceive. We are moving into this perceiving the world outside of the refined anguish of language because we need to know that there is a way of being outside of language. There is a way that we can begin to see the world outside of our judgments and our comparisons and our opinions and assumptions about things. And the more we learn to see that, the more we can begin to see some of the limitations that come with our opinions and judgments. And this, we can see the anguish that comes with language. And so this, we started out, I was telling a group of people yesterday that that it's so perfect where we are, because right now we're at the end of the triangle around the three characteristics. And we started with this talking about the three refuges. And then we are going to go starting next month with That's what's called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And Buddha actually said that that was the point of his practice, was the uprooting of greed, hatred, and delusion. But greed, hatred, and delusion is so outside of the refined anguish of language. Being able to see it is outside of it. I think greed, hatred, and delusion is all stuck within language, but being able to perceive it is outside of language. And so this triangle that we have been in around the three characteristics are really the kind of foundational pieces that help us begin to see something that's not actually manifest, like a table. It's not a thing. It's a knowing of something outside of this manifest world. And we're going to end tonight with this continuation into this discussion about non-self and beginning to understand non-self and what is this. I think I told you guys the last time I was here, inevitably we think non-self means there's no Tuere sitting here. And even our ordinary mind knows that's stupid. Of course I'm sitting here. Something's here. And so we try to visualize a non-self when non-self itself is not something to be visualized. It's something to be realized or something to be understood. And the more we can understand that, the more we can see when we're trapped in Mary Oliver's refine anguish of language. So I just want to frame our conversation that we're going to have tonight with three things to remember around non-self. Well, first of all, I love Ruth King's simple way of beginning to see life. She says, it's not permanent, it's not perfect, and it's not personal. That's so easy. We can remember that. Not permanent, it's not perfect, it's not personal. And yet, when something happens to us, we really think it's personal. We think something has happened to us. And it's very, very difficult for us to separate the thing that happened and us. And so this practice of non-self, you can think of it as having three possible ways of looking at it. One, everything about our lives is habitual. Everything. Everything, everything, everything. Everything. We put our clothes on the exact same way every time. I mean, that's why that, remember that game show? Some of you guys might be a little young for the game show, but there used to be this game show where I think the lightning round, you had to quickly say things that you did. So people would have to impulsively name things that they did or whatever. And ultimately, the game show was pointing to how habitual we actually are. We are just a habit. We are walking around habits. And so all we do is our sense of ground, our sense of stability comes from habit. There's nothing wrong with habit. So sometimes I think when we talk about the Dhamma, it can come across like we're saying, oh, we have to like be in these holy states of bliss all the time. But you don't. There's nothing wrong with habit. In fact, we want to create a habit to return to the breath or return to a meditative object so we can stay in the present moment. That is a habit that the mind can pick up. But you have to know when you're in habit. And this is what is hard to see. It's hard to see that we're moving in habit. And non-self, this practice of non-self, is a way to help us begin to see that we're moving in habit. And if you see that you're moving in habit, you could begin to see that maybe some of those habits, while they were great when you were 12 or 15, they may have even been great when you were 22. They just don't work when you're 47. Something's not, it's not jiving together because your present reality is very different than it was when that habit first came into being. So we're trying to learn how to see the habit part of our behavior so that we can adjust that behavior to the present moment. So we can live out of now and not out of just the habit that we've been doing all this time. The second part of this need to kind of connect to non-self is because, I mean, we're all practitioners. You don't have to sit very long quietly by yourself before you realize, yeah, I got some problems here. I got some stuff I got to work on. It does not take long to get that. Just sitting quietly and all of a sudden you're just like, oh my God. That's why we don't want to sit quietly, because we see so much. And we mostly see the stuff that we don't like. So if you take all of this stuff that you see personally, you cannot work on liberating yourself from it, because you get trapped in this idea that I'm just so messed up, it's not going to work. As some of you know that I have ADD, and if you don't know what ADD is, it is difficult to maneuver with meditation with ADD because we can't attend to anything. And so it's very hard to focus your attention. And then when you try to do something like meditation, which is this extremely subtle attention, it just doesn't, for years I thought this just isn't going to work. I don't have a kind of mind that can do that. I don't have a mind that can just focus on breath. That's just not possible. I couldn't even focus on my homework. So I certainly couldn't focus on breath. Or to make matters worse, even if I could focus on something, I couldn't stay with it. Couldn't stay with it very long. And so I just assumed that meditation, I couldn't do it. And I remember reading something from Trungpa Rinpoche. He was like one of the first teachers I ever read or knew anything about the Dhamma from. And he was, the way he was talking about it is more like, if you're having a problem with your practice, then you should be figuring out how to work with that problem and not deciding that practice isn't working. I just never thought of it like that. Like, if I'm having a problem with my practice, then the problem is what I should be figuring out. That's what I should be practicing with. And I remember sitting on sitting in meditation at Sims, and my mind cannot stay settled. My mind is jumping all over the place and I can't seem to find the breath. I know I was breathing theoretically because I was alive, but it's not like I could find it. And I remember thinking, well, what if I just paid attention to everything I was thinking about? So it didn't really matter. I mean, the fact that I knew I was thinking, I'll just pay attention to everything I was thinking about and see if I could remember every story I was thinking about. See, I at the time didn't know that noticing everything I was thinking about was an object of meditation. I didn't know that. I thought the object had to be the breath, and if I'm not on the breath, I'm doing something wrong. But gradually, I was training my mind how to be still in my own way. This is a lot of why I think the Buddha was made a big deal about non-self, because I think he wanted people, if you're going to see difficulty, if you're going to see into greed, hatred, and delusion, if you're going to see that, and you're going to see yourself involved in it, we have way too big of egos. We'll be too quick to try to smooth it over and make it seem like we're really not that bad. Or we'll tumble into this self-hatred and we're just not that good. And so non-self is this way of helping us see that what you see is not personal. It's not about you. It's about the human condition. It's about being human. And every single human in this room, on this call, in fact, every single person that tries to sit down and meditate is struggling with thinking. And yet, me, individual practitioner, I think there's something wrong with me because I can't seem to stop thinking. But it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with you. It has to do with being human and trying to focus your attention on a single object, and the mind's going to bounce off of it. So in that, if you see it as a human thing, that's what I think Trumpa helped me realize. That I could figure out my own way of trying to realize some Dhamma principle. And it wasn't about trying to get it right. So it's a habit mind. We are habitual creatures. It's a human condition that we're working with. And this third part of non-self is that it's empty. And emptiness, that is an English word. It is not the emptiness that the Buddha was pointing to. That is our English word. And since we're not beyond the anguish of language, we take the word emptiness and apply it to the Dhamma as if the Buddha was talking about voidness. Just nothingness, and that is not it. So the way I begin to help myself understand emptiness is think of emptiness as empty of opinion. So something is empty of your opinion about it, empty of your assumptions about it, empty of your words about it, and it is whatever it is. If we could take out our languaging in the world, then we would be open to the entire world. And emptiness would be everything. It would not be nothing. It would be everything. Because we wouldn't have all of these labels and boundaries and categories, and we wouldn't have the rules and the structures that force us to see things in one direction, to see things in this limited way of seeing. But if we could empty out, if we could empty out words, you could walk around a forest and be walking among thousands of beings, and you wouldn't be just you walking in a forest of trees, some kind of a thing that you're walking in. So if you're surrounded by beings and you're in that space with them, then you're all beings and you're open to the whole thing of it. So this understanding of emptiness, it requires that we let go of some of our languaging around it and open up into the experience itself. So all the teachings that the Buddha gave on emptiness were really designed to get us to let go of thoughts about something and just experience it as it is. He asked a monk one time, he said, do you have problems with things that you don't see? And the monk said, no. He said, do you have problems with things that you don't hear? And he's like, no. Goes through all the sense doors. And he goes, do you have problems with things that you do hear? It's like, yeah. Problems with things you do see, yeah. So he said, if you take out the you wouldn't have any problems. It was sort of like, that's it. So it's sort of like beginning to recognize that your ears don't have any problems with anything it hears. It doesn't have a problem. It doesn't distinguish between the beautiful bird song in the morning and some jackhammer that started a little bit earlier than 8. It doesn't. It's just sound, 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 sound. Your taste buds don't know the difference between whether you like it or you don't like it. I've tried to convince my taste buds to help me let go of sweetness because I love sweet and I hate non-sweet, but it is not working out. But I can tell that when I taste the tea and I put just a little too less sugar than I normally would, and I can feel this kind of like, but it doesn't taste right. I can feel that. It's not the taste. It's more that it doesn't think right, is a better way to say it. It's not the taste is whatever it is, and the taste buds certainly don't care. They're probably happy I'm letting go of some of the sugar, though. But so this emptiness that the Buddha was pointing to is to help us get outside of language so that we can just be in the world, be in our experience, exist on a plane that's different, that just accepts what is offered in the moment. So this is what we're trying to look into, a non-self. But I thought, I have a habit of just going on and on and on because I love talking about the Dhamma. But I'm going to stop here so I can take some questions and we can really... I just want you to begin to challenge yourself. Don't think about whether or not you have to ask a profound question or a good question or the best question. It doesn't really matter. Just whatever your thoughts are around this idea of non-self, assuming you can't understand it or you try to understand it, it doesn't make sense, or there are things that you think if you were to accept this idea of non-self that you'd have to let go of that you can't. So if there's anything, any comment or anything that you want to have, let's just take a moment to sit quietly and see what comes up. And then we'll talk a little bit more about it. Okay, so if anybody has anything, or we can sit quietly for as long as we want, we're okay. Yeah, come on. So we don't have to, we only have one mic. We don't have to use a... I do appreciate you coming up here, though.
Testing. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I had an experience at the Day of Mindfulness recently, I wonder if it has to do with Anatad. Maybe you could tell me. So I was sitting right about here, actually, and Tim invited us to expand our awareness to the room. And something clicked for me, and I felt like I was out in the room, and I could see myself as like a dense gray meatball. That's what I thought at the time. It's like, is that myself that I'm looking back at? And it felt really refreshing to be outside of that.
So it is a consciousness. But what I think of these images, when the mind comes up with images like that, you were actually having a felt sense experience. It was like a felt sense of anatta, having that felt sense of whoever you are is not just the body. It's something that actually knows the body also. But your mind can't really express that. So what it does is it creates images to try to explain what you're actually feeling. So that, I think that was more of the felt sense of consciousness knowing itself. And we have a level of consciousness that isn't tied to our bodies. It's why we could sit here and think about something that happened yesterday, and we're there in that thing. But you had this consciousness of both being here and knowing that you're outside of here. And that consciousness is what I think you experienced. It's like a felt sense of anatta, in that you're knowing the nature of who you are.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, come on.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So I've been kind of thinking about like this gradient of how that sense of non-self can be experienced. So sometimes it really is that really beautiful, connected, no boundaries, kind of that boundaryless, wordless state. Sometimes, though, it has a lot of, like, it feels like very on the edge of, like, fear and a bunch of chaos. And, like, It's like, but those opinions are how I'm, like, making sure I do good stuff versus bad stuff, how I go for wholesome versus unwholesome. So it's like there's a tightening at that moment, and it's very hard from that to, like, remember the forest.
That's right. You know, this is quite beautiful, because what you're pointing to is, and this is the nature of the way the Buddha unfolded his practice. He did not say any edicts, which is kind of a strange way. Usually in a spiritual practice, there are like rules about how to be good and how to be bad. And he didn't have those kind of rules. And so all of his teachings were considered trainings, and the whole point of it is for you to train in it, right? So when you notice this kind of, probably the best way to think about it is that game we used to play when we were kids called Operations, and you get the little on the side, and you're trying to get the leg bone out. But kids can figure out how to get that bone out by tempering their motor skills from the on each side. That's what you're describing. So sometimes you can tell when you've stretched outside of your limits of what you're comfortable with understanding, and that tension is really like the you're going too far. And then this boundlessness that you can feel, that's open, it's wide, it's vast, it feels like I need to be in this a while to remember that there is this part of me too. And that it feels safer. It's the same way with everything we do. So sometimes we're going to respond to people and you're going to feel that. And it's sort of like, that's how you know, oh, talking like that, something was off there. And it could be that you're were just taking it out on them and you were feeling bad, or maybe you felt some energy from them and you pushed back on that. I mean, you're using that tension and that this kind of freedom and tension as a way to help you guide and discern how to be. Because ultimately, if we're going to live more outside of the refined anguish of language, then we're going to have to live a lot more in the nebulous zone, if you're like a sci-fi people, you know, and you got to guide the ship through the nebulae, and it's always difficult, but so we got to guide it like that. But the only way to know how to move that way is to know that everything you're experiencing is helping you discern how to go, how to be, what's right, what's wrong.
Thank you. That's really beautiful. And I'm also going to have that sound in my head to kind of like remind me. Okay. Thank you. Beautiful.
That's good. Did you have something? Yeah. Come on. Yeah, use the mic though. Just so the Zoom people can hear.
I think when it comes to the ego, both at an intellectual level as well as by trying to, you know, build habits where I come less from that place, I've seen the benefits of it in relationships, at work, both internally but as well as in the outcomes that you see around you.
That's
so
right.
I definitely understand that piece. Then on the other hand, there is obviously the reality that you are living in this world, and not obviously to have a holier-than-thou approach, but you're obviously dealing with a lot of egos around you at home, at work, all of that. So you're living in that reality. And as much as you might try to, you know, be that light yourself, you have limitations yourself, and you're working with those limitations. So you have to live in that world of the egos as well, and both deal with not being taken advantage of, and at the same time also being effective in the world as much as possible. And I definitely also see that when you build that muscle of not coming from the ego, you're able to even do that. But I sometimes wonder if there is in some limitation also a function to the ego in a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Or would you say there is? Or would you say that one should transcend even that, and that there is no function for the ego at all?
No, I think there's a total function for the ego. So we have two worlds here. We are lay practitioners. And so we are going to live in a world that's a little different than the world, say, monastics are going to live in. And so monastics might be at some place where they're trying to transcend their ego altogether towards enlightenment. But the amount of practice and the amount of attention that you have to give to practice it's in conflict with trying to live a lay life, just because of what you're saying, just because of all the responsibilities. Like for monastics, they're trying to get rid of all their attachments. But as lay people, we are just building up on attachments. We got babies and partners and all kinds of new cars, new apartments, all kinds of stuff that we build up on. And so we are living in a world of attachments, and the monastics are living in a world where they're shedding all their attachments. So recognizing that we are living in a world as a lay practitioner where there's going to be ego, we need to cultivate that ego, and we need to be in a world with a lot of other egos. What I think non-self is for us is, so as a practitioner, you have a set of values that you want to live through. But trying to live through those values in the world like it is today is very difficult. It taxes us. It's a trying, it is the nature of our practice. So this idea of walking the Eightfold Path and right intention is to do no harm, to be as kind as you can and live in a life of restraint, then walking into that kind of a world as a lay practitioner can be difficult. But that is the nature of our practice. That's what we're doing. So it's not that we are trying to get rid of our ego. But, you know, the ego is very much concerned about you and only you. It doesn't really care about me. It can be nice to me occasionally, but that's only if I'm helping out you. And that is just the nature of every single ego in this room. So in order for us to live in a world where we need to cultivate a strong ego and you have to have a strong ego to be successful and just to go through life and be confident in life. So in order to cultivate a world where we are living in ego and at the same time we have these altruistic values of doing no harm and being kind and living with restraint, that there is our practice edge on how we're going to go about doing it. So it isn't so much about getting rid of your ego as much as it is noticing when your ego is coming in conflict with your practice vows. And when they come in contact with your practice vows, you're not going to set aside the vows. You're going to check the ego. And that kind of learning how to check the ego when it conflicts with your vows, that's what it is that we're practicing.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Anybody online want to ask a question or talk a little bit about this? Yeah, Jean. Can you unmute?
Yes. Okay. I need to ask this question before I get caught up in whether or not it's a smart question or the best one
good.
Of the night.
Jump right in with it, then. It's a smart question.
It seems to me that sometimes I have made the greatest of progress when there is a huge amount of humility. And I haven't heard that spoken of in terms of finding the non-self or becoming non-self. So I wonder, am I on the right track here, or is that something kind of off the wall?
Yeah, no. Do you want an example from him? Gene, can you? First of all, let me tell you, I think you are spot on. And humility actually is a very big part of Dhamma, even though we don't say it as much we don't use that word humility. But a lot of sati, so mindfulness itself, is steeped in humility. There has to be a degree of humility for us to be able to soften into whatever's happening and accept whatever's happening. We can't accept, just imagine, I'll give you an example. So let's say that you're sitting in your meditation and you're starting to get kind of still, right? You're not really so caught in the mind anymore. You're settling down. And you're having a sense of stillness here, right now. In that moment, what throws practitioners off is that all of a sudden, from out of the blue, some painful experience will come to your mind. Just boom, just like that. You'll remember something that, and the level of embarrassment. Nobody knows you are seriously embarrassed right now, but you're like, I have all this embarrassment because of something you did, because that memory comes up. If you get trapped in the memory, which is a self, this is like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. Oh my God, me, 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 me. You're going to just, it's like taking all the energy of that moment and shoving it back down in your body. It's usually coming up because it's energy that's roaming around in the body and you don't need it anymore. And the body knows it's there, but you ignore it. So as soon as you get still and quiet and peaceful and relaxed, great. The body's like, okay, finally, can we get rid of all the stuff that doesn't need to be here? And all this purification starts happening. There has to be a degree of humility that allows us to let this stuff pass through us and not become a albatross that we shove it back in. So you need a bit, you have to have the humility. Ajahn or Ajahn Analio, he refers to sati, mindfulness, as he gets a lot of flack for this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. He refers to sati as this receptive quality. So he says it's a feminine quality. This, it's not women, it's femininity, that there is this receptivity in our practice. So when we're sitting here, we have to be receptive and soft enough to handle whatever comes. And that softness and that receptivity, that attitude of receptivity is what allows us to go deeper and deeper and deeper. Because the deeper we go in our practice, the more old stuff has to get rid of. It has to be gotten rid of, gotten rid of, gotten rid of. And I always thought that stillness in meditation came from me being still. So I'm sitting here and I'm physically still. I'm making myself still. That is not where stillness comes from. Stillness happens when the reverberation of all the old energy, of all the old stories about you, all the old things that were done to you, things that you did, all the remainder energy that's stored in our bodies, waiting for us to be quiet and let it pass through. When all of that has been cleared out, then you walk around in stillness all the time. There's no, you don't have to make yourself still. Stillness comes from the capacity when you no longer have all the remaining energy in you. So in order for us to take, you know, we're older. In order for us to get rid of 60, 70 years of stuff that was done, energy we need to let go of. We need a degree of humility and this receptive attitude that's softer, that just allows it to come and go. And that is non-self. That is this capacity to realize I'm not the person that is in the memory I am remembering. I am, if you want to know who you are the person that is sitting there doing nothing, thinking about something that happened 30 years ago. And that event that happened 30 years ago is nowhere near the present moment other than a thought. And yet that thought can come up. And because it's energetic, we can feel it like it's happening right now. And get all intertwined in the, this is me, and I can't believe I do this, and I can't believe they did this to me. They're so wrong. And we get so caught in that, that it's like grabbing all that energy that was about to leave and shoving it all right back into the body. And then, you know, it's going to come up again later. It's going to keep coming up until it gets out. So the humility that you're pointing to is what's needed to help us steady ourselves and soften into the anxiety, the difficulty, all of the stuff that happens in meditation that makes meditation so hard to do. We got to have a degree of humility and stability, softening, I mean, in order to be stable and sit through it.
Thank you very much. And I will own that receptivity, femininity part of myself.
Yes.
Proudly.
You own that proudly. We need to. You know, we have a masculine side of ourselves too. We need both of them. And yeah, good.
Thank you.
Come on. I'm always proud of the people in the room. That seems like that's the hardest because you have to get up and come to the front. But we do that. I'm so proud.
Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I was wondering on a practical aspect what you were talking about, kind of when you're meditating, letting the thoughts, kind of observing them receptively without judgment. And I was just wondering if it's something fresher, how kind of long do you recommend letting the thought play out? Or, yeah, do you recommend just letting it play out and observing the whole time? Or is there, or do you more recommend coming back to the anchor?
So we all need a degree of concentration in order to do this, in order to let stuff come up and wash away. So the test is really more about, are you able to stay aware that you're sitting here thinking? Oftentimes we are thinking and we know we're thinking, but we don't know we're sitting thinking. We're just in the thinking and we're in that world. So the test is, if you have enough concentration to be able to steady yourself and know you're just sitting here thinking, then you can watch the thoughts and you can begin to see what they're saying and not be engaged with them. But if you find yourself going into the thought, and the only way you know you are thinking is because you, oh, I was thinking, you come back to the present moment, then you need to cultivate a level of concentration. And so oftentimes people, the concentration part is the hard part because it's this constantly coming back to an object over and over and over. And it seems like because your mind keeps bouncing off the object, that I must not be making any headway here because I keep leaving and going into thinking. But the leaving you are not doing. That's non. This is the need for non-self. You are not doing the leaving. The mind does the leaving. It just gets bored for whatever reason and it moves. What you do, if there's a way to calculate your part in the practice, is that when you wake up, if you choose to come back to the present moment and begin again versus just going back into thinking again, you are training the mind to choose coming into the present moment. And so it really doesn't matter how many times your mind goes away. This idea that my mind shouldn't go away, and therefore if it does, I'm not really practicing as well, that's actually backwards of the way the Buddha taught. It doesn't matter how many times your mind goes away. What matters is when you notice that the mind has been away, do you choose to start over again? So that starting over is meditation, not the not leaving. When you get to a point where starting over is not a problem. You just start over again and you can keep yourself steady for a little while and it's gone and you start over again. And then you find yourself kind of like knowing you're sitting here practicing. Then if a thought comes up, you could pay more attention to it and see more about it. But if you find yourself getting caught in the thinking, imagine that you are taking all that energy and shoving it back in the body and you're going to have to deal with it again. So you don't want to get entangled in the thinking if you're looking at it. One more thing. Just like you don't have to make yourself still, that when the body has cleared out all this excess energy that you're carrying around with you and you don't need it anymore, when it's cleared it all out, you will be still. Likewise, you don't have to figure out why the mind is thinking like this or why this thought is coming up. That understanding is a natural capacity that our brains have to understand, to realize things, to see things. And so what the Buddha was pointing to is, I think, he used mindfulness as a tool or as a way to steady the mind's attention. And then we can see there's a whole nother mind that can show up. And all of a sudden we can be sitting and understand some thoughts that we would not have understood if we were trying to figure them out. It's not something that you have to do. The only thing we have to do is to choose the present moment, choose the present moment, choose the present moment. And then we allow for the mind, this brain that we have, to actually open up into a whole nother way of understanding things. Things that are not manifest and tangible. It understands. A way to think of it is like this. If you walk into a grocery store and you go to the produce and fruit section, none of that produce and fruit is still on the tree or the vine. And yet we know which are alive and which are dead. We can tell, that lettuce, not alive anymore. And this lettuce, it is alive. How do we know that? It's not something that's tangible, but it's something that can be known. And it's the same way with understanding the nature of our thoughts and why they're there and what they're pointing to. We can understand that as just something that can be realized. Once we build up enough concentration to not get entangled with them when they show up. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense and it's very helpful.
All right, good. Oh, yeah. Come on, Deborah.
Try to articulate this. I really struggle with the difference between trying to drop judgment and opinion.
You may have to pull them
in order to see the world as it is, to be in the world as it is by having less opinions about it, but that can so easily lead to I don't give a damn, indifference, and apathy. Do you have a way to just to stay in the world without judgment, without just dropping caring?
Yeah. Did you guys hear that online? Okay. So, first of all, that judging, comparing, Philip Moffat does a whole bunch of work around that. It's such a habit. It doesn't have anything to do with you. So our minds are naturally going to judge whatever we see. We're going to judge it, good or bad, right or wrong. And we're going to compare everything. This sit was better than that sit. This chair is better than that chair. this view is better than that view, or it's worse than, or it's equal to. We just do that all the time. And we have a mind that sees problems constantly, and so it's always seeking a way to fix everything it doesn't like. You're not trying to get into a world where you stop doing that. Because if you try to get in a world where you stop doing that, then you're getting trap yourself into this kind of, I don't like myself because I keep judging and I don't want to do it anymore and I keep doing that. So we're not, you take the judgment, the comparing and this fixing kind of mind, and you accept that it is the nature of human beings to do this. And your minds are going to do it. But what you can do is diminish the impact of that judgment on how you see the world. So the mind's still going to judge, but you give less and less and less attention to the judging. The difference between I don't care, that's how I'm going to not judge, I don't care, that is, you're judging it, but you're going to convince yourself you don't care. I don't like that, but I don't care. I don't like that. I don't care. What I think the Buddha was pointing to something in practice, that it's just like with the energy in the body, and it gradually, the body gradually clears out all our old energy and we start getting stiller and stiller. If you had a practice that helped you kind of put some constraints about how you're going to be with your judging, then gradually you will have less and less and less enchantment by what the judging is saying. Do you see the difference here? If you try to stop judging, then it's like a no-win situation because the mind judges habitually. It's a human trait to do that. But if you begin to put some boundaries around the judgment, now you can get less and less and less enchanted by the mind's judging. So the mind can judge and judge and judge and judge and judge. You don't care. So I'll try to explain this with a story I told some time ago around, it's when we used to do tests at Spirit Rock, and I have a trauma mind, so I came from trauma, and so whenever anything happens unexpectedly to me, my mind immediately thinks some catastrophic thing is about to happen. The world is coming to an end. All hell's breaking loose. Let's get the hell up out of here as quick as we can. It doesn't matter what the unexpected thing is, but unexpected information creates this panic energy in me. And so I've lived with it my whole life. And I thought when I started practicing that energy would go away, right? I'm gonna practice myself right on out of that. No, I still have it. But I have a completely different relationship to it. So I was on a retreat at Spirit Rock, and they told us, this was when they were still doing COVID tests, and they had a system where they would do a COVID test at the very beginning, and then they did another one 4 days in. So when the teachers first got with the staff, this one of the staff, she told us that, oh, we're going to test you guys on Friday. And so my mind set in my mind on Friday. And then Thursday morning, she comes in and she says, oh, we're going to do the COVID test this morning. And I said, no, we're doing that tomorrow on Friday. She goes, no, it's today. And I said, well, but you said Friday. She goes, I was wrong. It's today. Oh, my God. My mind decided I had COVID. I was on a month long. So I had brought all these clothes to last for a whole month, and I had unpacked everything. And so I had been at Spirit Rock for a retreat just before then, and I had not been anywhere. I do not have COVID, but that is not what my mind thinks. It is literally freaking out, screaming, cussing me out for bringing all these clothes. You're not even gonna, they're just gonna kick you out. Your clothes are gonna be flying everywhere, and they're gonna be throwing you off the ground. Oh my God, it was merciless. It was terrible. But I don't identify with that anymore. I know that is just trauma. It's not me. And so I am just sitting, walking, giving instructions, doing interviews, and this mind is like screaming bloody murder. The tests are not until 2 o'clock. So all day I'm walking around with this mind. I'm in the present moment though, so I know what's happening. I'm sitting there, I'm talking to people, I'm going to lunch, whatever. We go into the room, big, huge meditation hall. It's all quiet. I'm very connected to the present moment. And I go in, smile, get my little COVID test. They're like, yeah, you're going to be kicked out. I can't believe it. You shouldn't have done this. I sit down. I'm watching everything. It's very quiet, very peaceful. And then she comes over towards me. And I could hear my mind say, this is it, this is it, we gotta go. But I'm looking at her, and she's smiling, and she's coming over to me, and she goes, okay, Tori, you can go. And then it was like this. Mind stopped talking. Because there's no more, I'm not going to get kicked out, right? It's over. Because the reality came face to face. Does the mind say, my bad? No. I was wrong about all that. I'm sorry. No. It just stops talking. That's it. And when I started learning that the mind just stops talking when it's wrong, I stopped listening to it. I started looking at what's actually happening in the moment. So the way you work with judgment is just that. You begin. Philip has this great practice that he says this little vow that says, for the duration of something, so I'm going to my sister's house. So for the duration of being at my sister's house, I'm going to renounce, like a practice, restraint. I'm going to renounce judging mine or comparing mine or fixing mine. I'm not going to go in her house fixing everything. And then he does this one little piece as best as I'm able. So if you notice that you're judging, then the noticing you're judging is as best as you're able, you're going to renounce it. Just let it go. And then as soon as you get out of your sister's house, you can go back to judging all the time. So you end up creating a way that you begin to change your relationship with the judging, rather than trying to somehow or another convince yourself that you're not going to judge anymore. Do you see the difference? The judging is human, but the relationship you have with it, that's you. That's practice. And so what we're learning to do is cultivate a different relationship. And so in my comparing mind, judging mind, fixing mind, it's all intertwined with trauma. So I just focus on the present moment. That's what I'm going to start looking at. I'm going to start noticing the faces of people. I'm going to start noticing how I actually feel. What's the posture of my body? What sounds are coming up? I get very, very, very attentive, very, very, very connected to the present moment, very concentrated in this moment and not what the mind is telling me. And gradually, I trained myself to just hear that trauma mind as the traffic. We just hear it all the time. we just ignore it. I mean, we're still having a fine time in here, and the traffic's been going the whole time, and we can hear it, but we don't care. We're not engaged with that. So it's a different kind of I don't care as much as it is what the Buddha called disenchantment. We're not enchanted by what this judging mind is telling us. And instead, we're enchanted by the present moment, the experience I'm having right now. And we get more and more and more enchanted by the present moment and less enchanted by what our thinking mind is saying. It doesn't have to stop screaming bloody murder, but I don't have to listen to it anymore either. It's a very different relationship with it. This capacity to do this comes from learning and trusting non-self. It comes from seeing this idea that Buddha's whole practice was based in this understanding that we are human beings. We are not, you know, you, me. We have bodies that do their own thing. We don't have any control over it. If we did, there are certain emotions I am certain I would not have anymore, but I cannot rule those out. There are certain feelings, anxiety being one of them. I would not have that anymore, but yep, nope. We don't have any control over these bodies. And so it's beginning to recognize that we live in the body and that we're responsible for the body's actions and thoughts and kind of our karma, but we do not have control over it. So all we can really do is begin to see where the lines are and how do I live more closer to my practice vows and less reactive to what the mind is, or the body. It's really the mind. Body's just following the mind. Do you see that distinction? Does that help some? All right. Good. Yeah. Do you want to have something, Beth? Okay. Because a plug? Okay. Yes. Oh, Dancing with Life? It's the best book ever.
I was just going to ask you. I was driving over here. So I'm
going to ask Tawari what the relationship with non-self and renunciation is.
Ah.
And you just answered it. So
that's right.
But it's in this book, and I wanted to share this. It's up on the table if you want to look at it. It's Philip Moffat is one of our precious teachers. And he wrote this really special book called Dancing with Life. And it's the structure is around the Four Noble Truths. But he talks about renunciation and the different, the judging, fixing, comparing, and then renouncing the need to have all my needs met. Being the star of my own movie.
Yep.
And I'll be working on that the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But,
he uses these momentary renounces, these momentary renunciations to help frame a moment of practice. So when you're going into some situation where you have a lot of difficulty, meetings where you really don't want to be there, family members that you always get into tussles with, you frame it around just renouncing in this little window of time. And then your practice becomes just giving that as a try. But there's no requirement that you get it perfect because it's practice. It's not edicts and expectations. It's just practicing. And you watch and see. And gradually over time, you begin to see you have way more capacity and resilience just from the practicing of these little bitty moments of renunciation. He really uses renunciation as a great gift for helping frame a moment of difficulty.
So if I could ask a real quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Your words about your intention for being as kind as you can be and living a life of restraint. When I first heard you say that, my grasping type that I am said,
I can't live like
that. Well, I can be kind. I can work on that pretty well, but this renouncing, I don't know. It's not in my vocabulary because it felt like, it feels like I'm giving up the good stuff.
Right, but you're not.
I know it's part of the mythology of the self. I mean, it's my structure. And when I do renounce, I feel like I'm white knuckling, right? I'm just like faking it. And like when you talk about the little periods of time, well, I'll just power through that. But
there's another way you could
feel
think
genuine
of it.
To me.
No, there's another way you can think of it. Like I love sugar in tea, right? I can't help it, man. Black tea was made for cream and sugar. And so I love it. So what I do is I put just a little less sugar and taste it a few times. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I'm going to get that sugar right. I'm going to put some more in there. But the renouncing is beginning to point myself towards noticing and seeing that I don't always have to have my way. It's not you have to renounce something and not do it anymore. It is this, that's why I use the word restraint. I have to have some restraint just to see what is it that this thing is doing to me. That's all you want to see. And you're practicing with it. So you give a little, you take a little, you give a little, take a little, back and forth.
Like an experiment.
Yes, it's an experiment. It's okay. Just a practice.
Thank you.
All right, good. We better stop. Thank you so much. This was a wonderful conversation. I hope it's opening your understanding around non-self so you don't hold it in this kind of woobly kind of, it is in the, you know, it's beyond the anguish of language, but it's still something that we can practice with and access. All right? Next month are the three poisons. So we start with greed. It's greed, hatred, and delusion. So maybe Tim will talk about all three of them, and then we'll move into beginning to look into one at a time each month. It's really good that we talked about non-self so we can actually look at greed, hatred, and delusion without getting all caught up in it. All right. So, well, is there anything that we need to say? There's nothing coming up or nothing to do. All right. Well, next week. All right. Thanks, Kaba. All right, good people then. So we shall see you. I will not be here for the month of July. I'm going to go teach a retreat at Spirit Rock. I'll be here on the last Monday of the month, and we are going to have a special person join us. We're going to have a Theravadan monk who's African-American man. I'm so happy to be able to bring him here. And so it's just a completely different framing, the way you can hear someone in a different way. And so I hope you'll all be here so we can support him in his monastic work. All right. All right. Thank you so much.